The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
Right, now, do you remember A Little House on the Prairie? Of course you do. And do you remember all the characters in it? Of course you do. And do you remember the particularly annoying one? Of course you do. That was Nellie Olson. Do you remember the ringlets, the voice, the pain inflicted on the people she knew in every episode? And yet, for some reason, you kind of liked her because you wanted to see her every week. Well, 40 years later, she's written probably one of the best titled books I've ever heard of, which is Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated. What a story, and what a pleasure it is to welcome the woman herself. Alison Irongrim, welcome to the programme. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
When you meet people... Sorry, Alison. You're such a part...
I'm loving the introduction. I'm still laughing from the introduction.
You were such an important part of an Irish generation's childhood that I'm trying to figure out, what is the most common reaction you get now as an adult when you say to people, that was me, I was Nellie Olson?
I do get this look of sort of wide-eyed horror, even from grown people. During the show, I had someone throw a cup of orange soda at my head during a Christmas parade. I had children kick me. I had people throw things, yell, scream, carry on. But just a couple of years ago, I was at an autograph show, and this is, current time, and a woman, a grown person in her late 40s, came in, and she didn't say hello or good morning or anything. She just came up, looked incredibly angry, and just smoke coming out of her ears, and looked at me and said, I forgive you, and walked out.
And she obviously had been sitting on this anger for some time.
She's holding it in. I thought, God, she finally got it out. My husband thought it was hilarious. He said, now, was that just for the show or for everything you've ever done? Are you now absolved for your entire life by this woman?
You were born in 1962. So that brings us then to maybe 8 or 9 years to the point of you being cast in this. Why were you cast? Because they were obviously looking for a particular type of, I was going to say person or creature. Alison, I love you, even though I've only just met you. But why you?
Well, why me? A good question. Well, I had been a child actress since, my Screen Actors Guild card says a member since 1967. So I was working at 5, 6, 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And I had done a movie when I was 10. So I almost established as a child actor. And I actually hadn't worked a lot since the movie. And I remember my father said, you may be washed up. This might be it. You might not work again for years. So I always say Little House on the Prairie was my comeback at 12. Okay. So I was auditioning for things, and I actually auditioned for the part of Laura, for the part of Mary. I kept going back. And I thought, I hadn't read the books. I didn't know there was Nellie Olson. So I come in with my father, and they hand us these pages, and we're sitting out in the lobby, and I'm going over the page. No idea. I have no idea about this character. And I start reading them, and I turn to my father, and I said, this isn't a normal part. This girl's, she's a total bitch. And he starts laughing hysterically. And I read it for him. He starts laughing. He says, don't change a thing. Mm. Don't touch it. Don't do anything. Don't breathe. Don't even look at it again. You read it exactly like that. And I went, and there was Michael Landon and Kent McRae and Ed Friendly, the original producers, and I started reading, and it was that first episode where I talk in the school about how much everything in my house cost. It's a class essay, and it's my home is the best home in all of Walnut Grove. They were in a certain, they couldn't stop laughing, and they said, can you do it again, please? And I said, oh, yes, did you want me to change something? They said, no, just do the thing about the house again. And I read it, and they laughed hysterically again. By the time I got home, less than half an hour, they had already called my agent and made the deal, and my wardrobe fitting was next week. I was hired on the spot. It was something, Michael was very big on don't act, just come in and do it very realistically. Yeah. And whatever I did, I hit a nerve.
You sure did. And you hit all of our nerves around the globe. The shot that echoed around the world.
Right.
Michael, you referred to as Michael Landon, who is this wonderful presence on screen for a lot of people as the kind of that ideal father figure. But by all accounts, a particularly nice fella.
Really? Yeah. I mean, he was very much a taskmaster. I mean, on the show, he was the executive producer, and he was directing, and he was writing, and he was starring in it. He was doing everything. So he did oversee the whole thing. And we did shoot these huge episodes that were like practically hour-long movies, and yet it was happening in 5, 6, 7 days.
Yeah.
So we did go at a furious pace, and you knew your lines, and you hit your mark. But then he wanted to laugh. He had this high-pitched, infectious giggle. He laughed like a girl. You'd know he'd arrive for work. And he wanted to play practical jokes, and he liked working with the children, and he was just absolutely fabulous. One of the funniest, most talented, marvelous people I ever worked with.
Let me ask you, Alison, about something that's very familiar to a lot of people listening to this program, because of Irish dancing involves a lot of ringlets, would you believe? And you were kind of... You were the ringlet queen at that young age,
yes,
as Nellie Olsen. And with that in mind, can you give me a sense of the follicle pain you had to suffer in order to succeed?
Absolute pure torture. It's true. The way they tried curling my hair when it started. My hair does not take a curl. It's very straight. And they tried curling my hair, which meant I was 12 years old and sleeping in curlers and coming in at 4 in the morning. It's a disaster. And then they said, all right, we're having a wig made. And so they had a custom-made wig. Very beautiful, very expensive. But this meant a giant metal comb that dug into my scalp and dozens of pins to hold it on. Well, because it had to stay on during mud fights and going down hills in wheelchairs and things. So it was practically nailed to my head. Mm. It was excruciatingly uncomfortable, and I had to wear it for 9 hours a day.
Well, no wonder you were a bitch.
Yes, exactly. That's what's so mean. It was that, if you had that thing on your head, you'd be terrible, too.
Wouldn't you? You'd be shooting out at everyone going, God damn you all. But were you in real life a good person and a lovely person?
I like to think so.
No, you're allowed to toot your horn here. I mean, were you a good person who was just masquerading as a complete...
Oh, indeed. My husband says, before that first cup of coffee in the morning, it's, Nellie Olsen walks among us. But once I've had the coffee, really, I'm quite nice. I was a very shy child. Mm. I was the child who got beaten up by the bullies at school. I was more the child who would have been a victim of a Nellie Olsen. I was not that type at all. And that's why it was such a shock that I wound up playing this terrifying person. So it was kind of great because then everyone was afraid of me.
Well, that's a strange role for you then as a civilian in school, because one minute you were being bullied for whatever reason, and then you're being feared. So your child, your real childhood must have been a tricky road to travel.
It's like having whiplash, because absolutely one minute I was at school and I was, I had friends, I had people who liked me, but and that was a very smart thing. I stayed in school, so I kept all my old friends, which is good, who didn't care that I was on TV. So I had friends, but if anything, I wasn't in the big popular fancy clique or group, and the girls who were mean and awful and bullied people absolutely saw me coming and said, well, let's go throw her across the room. And so all the awful people, and I was shy. Then once I got Nellie, things turned around. It was amazing. People were intimidated by me. There were people who hated me. There were people who were afraid of me. Luckily, my regular friends just looked at me like I was crazy and said, how on earth are you playing her? This is the most bizarre thing we've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. But you were gravitated towards, the bus I travel on, which is the nerd bus. And, nerds are good people, aren't they, generally speaking, Alison? Would that be fair? I'm feeling quite needy asking you that, but you get the point.
I hung out with all the geeks. I was a very nerdy, bookish child. And I actually, at one point in junior high, there was a girl who was absolutely determined she was going to beat me up. And the boys from my algebra class showed up, and they protected me. I was saved by nerds.
I can't imagine they were a serious threat to anybody, but good on them.
That was the thing. They were all sort of going, hi-ya, as if they all knew karate. And I thought, well, at least there's 10 of them. Maybe they'll stand a chance against her. they weren't really physically imposing. They were very brave.
I was going to say, 10 algebra nerds equals one strong woman in the schoolyard.
Yeah, they were very brave.
They'd understand that ratio, staying with your childhood, when you wrote your book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olsen and Learned to Love Being Hated, that was a book that allowed you, as I understand it, and I hope I'm not overstating the case, Alison, but allowed you to confront the bogeyman in your life, which was something horrible that happened to you when you were younger. Can you talk us through that, if it's not too much?
I can. I talk about this openly in the book, that well, it's also one of the reasons why it was so such a bizarre turn of fate that I wound up being Nellie Olson. When I was very young, I was abused. I was physically and sexually abused. I was a victim of sexual abuse as a child. And, of course, you don't tell anyone, you know, because they tell you no one will believe you. They tell you they'll kill you. They tell you you'll get in trouble. So, of course, you don't think. You're six. You don't really think clearly that, of course not, he'll get in trouble. What am I doing? You think like a six-year-old. So, of course, you wind up not telling anyone. It's awful. And this went on for a couple of years. And so I didn't tell anyone. So by the time I had the show, it had stopped. But I still had this secret I didn't dare tell anyone. And this absolutely contributed to my being shy and awkward and being bullied. And I eventually only had therapy. But I wound up going public. And I really went public because of a marvelous group, the charity that I'm on the board of, Protect.org. We wound up going into Sacramento, the capital of California, and, well, we've done several states now, and changing laws to benefit and better protect victims of sexual abuse. And because I got involved with that group, I wound up telling my story in public. And then so when I did the book, I thought, well, I'll tell them everything.
You make an excellent point in this book, which is there are layers of abuse. It's all horrible, mm-hmm. but there are layers within the horror.
Yep.
And by that I mean, definitely. If it's a family member, you know, as you say, and I'm quoting you, you say, when people find out about sexual abuse of a child, and if it's a stranger, people grab their rifle and hop into a pickup. But when it's a family member, they don't know what to do. They put down the rifle and think, we've got to get them help.
Yeah, yeah. They're not. Their sympathy is initially with the child. And then they say, oh, well, it's someone you know who abused them. It's your cousin, your brother. Oh, well, you know, maybe. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
5 minutes ago, you were ready to call the cops.
Yes. And what happens there?
It's awful, and that's what happens. That's why these people do it. These people who are predators, who seek out children, they tend to become the swim coach, the school teacher, the tutor, the priest, the counselor, so that they have access to kids. There are men who seek out women with children, single mothers, because they know if they're married to them, they're less likely to turn them in, and that the children are less likely to tell.
So I'm listening to a podcast at the moment called Where is George Gibney? And it's about a very famous swimming coach in Ireland who was feted on television and the radio and so on. And yet it was a reign of terror on young people by this poolside and beyond. And it actually is quite disturbing. And what the point I'm making here, Alison, by bringing that up is because you mentioned swimming coaches, but that's not the point necessarily. It's that in this program, they interview people who are now parents to maybe older than that again. This sickness and the guilt, which I hate because, of course, the guilt belongs to the perpetrator, not the victim, follows people to the grave. It's so horrible.
You get post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes,
it's awful, yes.
And in some states in the States, you can't go to prison. Is that right for if it's a family member involved in sexual abuse?
Our laws are very strange over here. You know, we have 50 states, and it's like each one's its own country. And one of the things they did is they had what they call an incest exception. Now, we've gotten this change. I'm proud to say that our gang at Protect have changed in several states. But there are states where if you were to sexually abuse the child next door, you might get 20 years or more. But if it's your own child and you have the lawyer, he could say, oh, no, you see, under this section of the law, he doesn't have to go to prison. He's eligible for probation, no time served, and even what they call deferred entry of judgment. So no sex offender list, no record.
Good Lord.
Turn around and open a school the next day.
And that's part of your desire to change law-wise.
Absolutely. And then you have the statute of limitations laws where, I mean, some of them were so bad, it was almost as if, you know, if you didn't report by the time you were 17 or something, it's like, good heavens, these people were abused and they're small children. Are they supposed to turn around at 9 and call the cops? I mean, how do they know? Yeah. So giving people more time to report, and then absolutely this whole syndrome where it's almost always someone known to the child and very often a family member. Yes, there are strangers who may come and take your children, but most of the time it's going to be someone you know.
Do you, how has it affected you, Alison, as an adult, in the sense that you sound so outgoing and on the face of it like a very happy person, which I've no doubt you are, but does what happened to you as a six-year-old and 7 or 8-year-old, does it haunt you, or have you been able to compartmentalize, or how do you fix that?
I can say it doesn't haunt me now. I mean, it certainly did when I was younger. And I definitely had post-traumatic stress disorder type symptoms and absolutely sought professional therapy, very lovely people who I talked to. And but over the years, and then in doing the activism with Protect, I mean, they found things. I mean, I was at an AIDS conference years ago, and they were saying that people with HIV with AIDS had a better immune response and lower virus count if they were volunteering to help other people or doing activism. So it's we know it's mentally good for you to get out there and volunteer and help people, and it's physically good for you. And I know that that's been very helpful. As an adult now, I'm not, you know, in a position where I'm afraid. I'm not a little girl anymore, and I've done so many things now that really has helped, and helping others and having the therapy, so it's not the same, thank heavens. But it did, absolutely. I mean, it is one of the reasons that as a young girl, I was very shy and I was very awkward. And I was always afraid that people would see something different about me. They could tell. And it was a horrible way to live.
In happier news, if I may, move towards your, I suppose, virtual visit to Ireland now, sadly, but you were due to be here as keynote speaker.
I was so excited I was coming to Ireland.
We would have had you in studio talking face-to-face. Would have loved to have bought you a coffee, but you're going to be talking at the Women in Business Creating New Leaders by Walking the Walk event. And to just to endorse the connection of your connection to Ireland, your grandfather's family are the Bannons. Now, you can be a Steve Bannon working in the White House for Donald Trump and his shoulder, or and
you, definitely not the Bannons with an I. Bannons with an I.
It's Bannon with an I. Let's get James, that right.
Yeah, James Bannon. James Bannon came over. I remember seeing some documents that my father Bannon's in the 1840s, and there was, you know, usually the boats that went to Ellis Island, but the other boats that went to Newfoundland in Canada.
Yes,
and so this huge Irish family of the Bannons settled through Canada, and my father was born to a, you know, a very young woman who was unwed, and so he was in the orphanage, and he was named Wilfred James Bannon. And then he was adopted by Icelandics, which is why I have the crazy last name, because my father got adopted and named Thor Hudler Marvin Arngrimson.
Absolutely. I see. He's a great superhero in the Marvel series, and I love him.
And so, yes, so he's Icelandic, but absolutely we're Irish as can be.
Well, that's tremendous. And, you know, as I always say about Iceland and Ireland, it's just one letter dividing us ultimately.
It really is. And, you know, and when the Vikings came through Ireland and vice versa, everybody went everywhere. And this conference, it was marvelous. So I was approached to do this. And actually, it was funny because I met Samantha Kelly on Twitter.
Yes.
And she said, well, yeah, I'm doing this networking conference and people are speaking. It sounds like your kind of thing and you're very inspiring and you do all sorts of things. You keep reinventing yourself, you know, when you're an ex-child star, you're not supposed to be able to do anything properly. And, of course, I do like everything. I'm constantly working. And so she said, you should come and speak. And I was like, oh, this is great, because I was going to be in France in September, October, doing my comedy tour because I do a show in France. And so I was just going to pop on over to Ireland and come speak. Well, of course, now I'm not going anywhere, am I? So we're doing the whole thing from the living room now.
Well, that's good. Well, look, when you vacate the living room and the planes are running and we're all friends, we're all vaccinated up to the hilt, come to Ireland, come home, and we look forward to seeing you.
I will.
Yeah.
Oh, I really want to. But yes, marvelous. October 21st, this whole thing that's going to be virtual so everyone can go. You can all just turn it on in your house and buy a ticket and come. I'm doing stand-up comedy the same way. I had a show in New York and said, well, you can't come to New York. We can't do the show. And then they called back and said, do you want to do it online? You perform it in your living room and it goes out pay-per-view and they watch it on the computer. I said, all right.
Well, everyone can follow you. You're very active on Instagram, at Alison Arngrim on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn, and everywhere you go, you're there. You've got a great presence.
On everything,
You've been a delight to talk to, Alison. I really, really enjoyed meeting with you this morning. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. I should come back. Yeah, it's crazy. When the pandemic hit and everything I was doing, most of my things involve crowds of people and traveling.
Yes.
So everything I was doing was canceled, and I didn't know what to do, but my husband said, oh, you'll think of something. And then I did. And next thing I knew, I'm reading Little House on Facebook. I'm doing a movie next week. I'm doing this conference on October 21st. I'm just doing endless things online, and it's really quite fun.
Well, good luck with it all, and thanks again for your time. Real pleasure, and I look forward to meeting you in real life soon.
Thank you so much. Yes, I do too.
Thank you, Alison. Alison Arngrim joining us from the United States of America, from California to be specific. And what a pleasure to talk to her. As I say, she was known to a lot of you as Nellie from Little House on the Prairie once upon a time. But what a story she has, and love her take on it. Candid and humorous along with it, which is just terrific. Lovely. Alison Arngrim. The text number, as always, this morning is 51551.